In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Time to talk movies. Alan Adams of The Main Edge here for Pass the Popcorn. Brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, where they have a film for everybody in the family. Alan is here talking movies and weather, storm windows. How do you lose a storm window?
It's not even like one, because I came home and it was like, I mean, just shattered in the middle of the driveway. So it's like I'm out there in the gale force winds and the rain, like trying to clean up the glass so I'm not running, grinding it into the driveway. And then I get a call from Sheridan this afternoon being like, oh yeah, we lost another one off the off the back of the house. It's you know, can I just say, and I know there are people out there who are listening who are you know, at least partially to blame for this. It's GD Thunderdome out there on Broadway right now. Like, people, it's like, you know, use your heads, people. Like, yeah. It's very simple. Like, it's a four-way stop. The lights are off. Right. It's a four-way stop. You know how four-way stops work. You have a driver's license, so at least at some point you knew how four-way stops operated. But yeah, just watching people blow through those intersections and stuff, it's just like, come on, man. Like, I know you're very important and you're very busy, but, you know, like, these are the things that keep society together. Like, you know, it's like, you know, you start ignoring stuff like that and it's anarchy. And do you want anarchy out there on Broadway just because a few trees fell down in the wind?
Well,
no.
See, you know, you say that, and we started school today over in Brewer, and then the power went out, and so we ended up sending people home, and that was an adventure because we have students from so many different towns that we had to coordinate with all the different bus companies and get them there. And of course, it all began to fall apart quickly. The teachers, like, what do we do? There are no lights. Can I still give a test? Do I sit them near the window so that can I let them use their cell phones for light while they're taking a test? And I'm thinking, you know, maybe not give the test.
Yeah, maybe hold off on the test.
And I'm watching that, and I'm watching them, you know, 'cause everybody's got a cell phone, trying to communicate with home. And I thought, all I could think of was that episode of Twilight Zone, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. No, flip off the power for a few hours, and it won't take long for us to start eating each other.
Yeah, no, it's just like it's Lord of the Flies stuff out there, and it's one of those things where it's like you like to think that that people are generally good, and then you're driving out there on Broadway, and it's like, oh no, I'm wrong about that.
Yeah,
people are terrible. Everybody is terrible. and all it takes is a power outage to reveal everyone's true colors. It's brutal, brutal.
And then there will be those good people, those neighbors who help out and drag the giant limb out of the middle of your driveway.
Sure, sure. No, it's funny, actually. Sheridan was telling me a story. One of her coworkers lives out kind of in the boonies a little bit in Old Town. And there was a huge tree down, like basically just blocking the road. So she gets out to try and like move this tree out of the way. Four people drive by without a glance. Like, she's moving this giant tree and people are just blowing by, just like, oh yeah, hey, thanks. You know, good work, I guess. But it's just like, come on, like, we should all come together in times like this.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, maybe it's because it's short term. When we had the ice storm and it lasted forever and ever, people chipped in and
I suppose that's true.
Helped each other out. And may they know, hey, it's going to be sunny later on. So screw all of you. I gotta find a Dunkin' Donuts that's got power, which seemed to be the large crisis for people in Bangor. I was telling Carrie, the one Dunkin' Donuts that appeared to have the capacity to make hot coffee was the one closest to my house. But the line was about 3 miles long to get I guess I don't need it that badly after all.
Oh, God. We're animals. Like, when you scratch the surface just a little bit,
right.
Animals.
Yeah, I've been incredibly insulated because I got here at like 7:30, 7:45 this morning, brought my lunch with me, and I've been in here. We were without power for like half a second when the generator kicked in. And so it's been just a normal work day for me.
Sure.
Completely insulated from everything out there. So I'm glad the wasteland is at bay.
Yeah, no, it's going to be like Carrie's going to be like coming out of the fallout shelter, at the end. Just like you know, what is?
We got bags of Halloween candy delivered today, for goodness sakes.
Wow. Life is good if you're Carrie Askell, apparently. Some things never change. All right, let's talk movies. Which one do you want to chat about first, Mr. Adams?
Let's talk about Suburbicon.
All right. Which I want to be good.
Yeah, I wanted it to be good, too. It's directed by George Clooney from an old 10-year-old script by Joel and Ethan Coen. Matt Damon stars, Julianne Moore, and its biggest issue is it's trying to be too many things. Like, it wants to be like a biting social satire, and it wants to, you know, have something important to say about race, and it also wants to be a screwball murder mystery. And, you know, it tries to do all these things and ultimately really succeeds in doing none of them. It's the year's 1959, you've got this model community called Suburbicon, and it's basically a suburb. It's very deliberately placeless. Like, it's not like it's a suburb of any particular place. They make it very, you know, they're very careful about addressing any of that stuff. You've got a little boy living at home with his financial planner dad, played by Matt Damon, and his mom, who is named Rose. She's wheelchair bound, played by Julianne Moore. And they're also spending a lot of time with his Aunt Maggie, who is also played by Julianne Moore, because they're twins.
Ah.
So you got that going. Meanwhile, an African-American family has moved in, and the people of Suburbicon, 1959, not super psyched about it. there's a simmering tension that does not take very long at all to boil over. The kid's dad, Matt Damon, there's a home invasion. And the dad and the kid and the aunt and the mom are all tied up by these shady guys who come in to rob the place, tie them up and chloroform them. Because Rose, the mom, is so ill already, it's too much for her. And she ultimately passes away. It soon becomes clear, however, that there might be a little bit more to the story than just a simple home invasion. We start to see that maybe, just maybe, Gardner Lodge, that's the name of Matt Damon's character, might have been involved in a way that's maybe a little bit sinister.
Mm.
Particularly when you see the burgeoning relationship between him and Aunt Maggie.
Oh.
Yeah, no, it gets weird. Meanwhile, it's what seems like the entire town has basically surrounded the home of the African-American folks and spends all day and all night banging on drums and shouting and generally being really venomous and hateful towards these poor people who are just trying to, you know, live a better life here in the community of the future, Suburbicon. Gardner Lodge's plan falls apart thanks to no small part to the boy, who has a lot of questions about what's going on. Before long, things spiral out of control. You'd like to think that people get their comeuppance, but, you know, some do and some do not. I didn't hate Suburbicon. When you tilt your head and squint, you can definitely see the Coen Brothers movie that it was supposed to be. I just don't think, and it's weird because Clooney's so good when he works with the Coen Brothers as a performer. I think he's very simpatico with their general like style and aesthetic. But as a director, he's a little too old fashioned, I think, to really do justice to that sort of quirkiness in terms of a script. Clooney's clearly a guy who, in terms of his directorial aesthetic, draws from the golden age.
Right.
You know, like those are the movies that really resonate with him. And that's great. And, you know, a lot of times it works really well with the choices that he makes. Unfortunately, a movie like this, with so many moving parts and so many sort of disparate themes and ideas, Like, it's just, he's just not built to make this kind of movie. And so it never quite succeeds in connecting the dots. And it's just structurally, it's just a little bit wanting. Damon's fine. The kid is very good. Julianne Moore is clearly delighted to be playing twins. And there's something to be said for that kind of, you know, that joie de vivre kind of coming through a performance like that. And there are a couple of Coen mainstays. Oscar Isaac shows up as an insurance claims adjuster for a couple of scenes and is just dynamite. But ultimately, it's just, the pieces just don't fit together. Like, it's just not that necessarily the picture doesn't match the picture on the box. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're putting the puzzle together. So Suburbicon could have been really good. Instead, just kind of meh.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think back on the films that Clooney has directed, and I loved the first two. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind was great.
Yeah.
And then his film on Edward R. Murrow.
Oh, yeah. Good Night and Good Luck.
It was fantastic.
Really good movie.
But was Leatherheads
yes,
the next
he,
one?
He directed Leatherheads.
And then The Ides of March.
Yes, which I like The Ides of March more than most. I like The Monuments Men a lot more than most people did. But ultimately, like, yeah, it's that. But he makes that kind of movie, the kind of movie that, the kind of movie that you could see like Clark Gable starring in.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, tell us about Jigsaw then.
The reality is, there was a stretch there for, I think, from 2004 to 2010, where you could basically set your watch by there being a Saw movie. And again, like, it's like with any franchise, law of diminishing returns and whatnot, but they were all very successful. Those first seven movies, I think, altogether did close to $900 million total box office. Yeah, it's an astonishing number. I will say, I thought the first movie was really innovative and interesting. I thought, it kind of touched a nerve and maybe shifted the conversation a little bit as far as horror movies are concerned, kind of opened the door for the folks like Oren Peli's and his Paranormal Activity movies, Jason Blum and the Blumhouse crew and all that stuff. But ultimately, the movies just got more and more, like, outlandish. And again, like, the basic formula is the same. Like, random crazy guy kidnaps people who he has some sort of moral issue with, puts them in a series of increasingly ludicrous and Rube Goldbergian traps that they have to save themselves from in order to prove their the purity of their souls. Or I don't really understand what the deal is. It's like you have to be sorry about being a terrible person, I guess, is what it boils down to, and that's literally the plot of every single one of the movies. So you could see why they'd be like, okay, we've pretty much worked through all this. They were gonna walk away. And then somewhere along the lines, someone was like, oh, man, those Saw movies made a lot of money. We should make another one of those. And then they did exactly that. It's literally the same movie. It's the same dude, Tobin Bell, playing John Kramer / Jigsaw. Same creepy puppet on a tricycle still around. Same ridiculous traps the whole written, narrative with where everyone's a suspect. And so nobody's a suspect. And it's like, eventually, I mean, like 15 minutes into the movie, you're like, oh, yeah, no, that's the one. That's the person who's helping Jigsaw, kill all these people because reasons. It's never really been made clear what the motivations are behind, these people's actions. Again, that's as much plot synopsis as really you need. Like, I could give you the names of the characters, but really, who gives a crap? It doesn't matter. Like, their names don't matter because there's no characterization there. They're all one note. They're either, defined by their single act of being a bad person or whatever. That's literally all you get in terms of who they are. There's a dirty detective in there and some weirdo medical examiners like examining the dead bodies of the people who get sawed up or chopped up or get their legs strung up by wire or drowned in a grain silo. It's so like. I just don't understand. Like, I guess that's the thing. Like, and I'm someone who, like, I like a good horror movie. I do.
Yeah, I do too. But I've looked at that whole series as essentially torture porn.
And that's the thing. And I think the reason why the first one worked as well as it did was because it didn't have that sort of stigma attached to it. Like, you didn't know what was coming, and so it was genuinely scary. I think it was, you know, gratuitous and gory and all that stuff, but at least it was in service to a story. It was in service to a narrative. And then somewhere along the line, and by that I mean in the second movie going forward, that sort of, you know, that was sort of pushed to the side, like, and storytelling became secondary to let's see how many, like, weird bear trap contraptions we can strap to people's heads and cut people up. And it's just like, you know, that loses its appeal fairly quickly, unless, you know, and again, like $900 million. So what do I know? But but ultimately, especially in a time when we're seeing a lot of really, really high quality horror movies being made, it just seems a shame to waste the time and money that must have gone into developing and making this movie happen. It's like, we don't need an eighth Saw movie. We just don't.
Right.
And there are all these puzzles that need to be solved. That's the biggest one of all. Like, who thought we needed another one? And the answer is, as far as I can tell, no one.
Alan Adams breaking it down for you here on Pass the Popcorn, brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, Stillwater Avenue, excuse me, in Bangor. Alan, before we let you go, we'll talk about it more on Wednesday, but big event. You were on the Pulse Morning Show today talking with Don and Paul about it, but the fourth annual Improv Me Festival coming up this weekend.
4 years, man. That's really pretty unbelievable.
It's crazy.
This weekend, November 3rd and 4th, three sessions over the course of 2 days, eight improv groups from all over Maine and beyond, descending on the Next Generation Theater in Brewer, to hopefully make you laugh a little bit. We've got a session on Friday night, 8 to 10 p.m. The focus group, our group, will be leading things off, followed by Farmington's own Teachers Lounge Mafia, and closing with the fine folks from Improv Acadia down in Bar Harbor. The first session on Saturday is 5 to 7 p.m. It's going to feature Bangor's own Queen City Improv, followed by a group out of Southern Maine, Mainly Improv, and Camden's The Cool Kids Table. And then that night, 8 to 10 p.m., it's going to be us again, double dip of the focus group here at the Improv Me Festival. After us will be Portsmouth, New Hampshire's Stranger Than Fiction. And closing will be a group from Improv Boston. They always kill it, and I have no reason to think they will do otherwise this time around. Each session's $10, although there will be a limited number of all festival passes available. For $25, you will have admission to all three sessions. So get them while they're hot, and come out, see one, two, or all three. I think you're going to have a really good time.
That's fantastic. And all sponsored by our friends at Gagan Brothers Pub and Craft Brewery. Since day one of the Improv Me Festival, the sponsor of what we do.
Yeah, no, Gagan Brothers has been the producing sponsor, since the get-go. And they've always been really, really great to us. And not only in serving as the sponsor for this festival, but also giving us a delightful place to eat wings and drink beer.
Well, yes.
After it's our traditional post show hangout,
right.
Which is pretty great. Our media sponsor, the Main Edge, and our hospitality sponsor, back on board for, I believe, the third year, the folks at the Fireside Inn and Suites. So yeah, it's a really, It's a really great time. A lot of great support from the community. And I hope to see you folks out there.
Awesome. Thanks, Al. We'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah, you will.
It's Alan Adams from the Main Edge Improv Me Festival this weekend. We'll talk more about that later in the week.